Blog Talk Radio.
This is G for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, and welcome to G for Yourself. It's great to have you with us, wherever you happen to be in the world at this moment. Our guest today adapted her horse-inspired insights into powerful tools. Linda Kohanov aimed those insights toward developing collaborative leadership and also for managing change. She says master herders of nomadic herding cultures developed a multifaceted and socially intelligent form of leadership, combining the five roles of dominant, leader, sentinel, nurturer, companion, and predator. And we'll look at some of those in just a moment. Linda Kohanov is the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. And Linda, turn the book title around a bit. We're looking at a model of socially intelligent leadership. What are the main features of that type of leadership?
Compassion combined with power, courage combined with self-control, and holding people accountable while also refusing to see them as helplessly defective.
Hmm. And what are we referring to? I know most of us have seen herders or are familiar with the herding cultures, but what is a master herder?
I was actually researching the history of leadership in multiple cultures across time for my fourth book called The Power of the Herd, and I found that these nomadic pastoralists, these are tribes that migrate with large animals, were able to employ this amazingly nuanced, socially intelligent form of herd management that is relevant now to us, because in this day and age, we are freer than we've ever been before, yet we still are using the tools associated with a command, control, hierarchical, dominant, submission form of power for the most part. And the interesting thing about these nomadic pastoral cultures is that these people have to deal with predators and changing climates. They have to protect and nurture the group while keeping these massive, sometimes aggressive horses and cattle together. And here's the key, they have to do this without fences and with very little reliance on restraint. And right now, due to increased information on the internet and increased travel opportunities, many of us are noticing that all the old fences are falling down, and we need more sophisticated leadership skills to keep people together and all moving in the same direction when we don't have the same social controls we used to have. So what I noticed was that in those cultures, this phenomenon of what I came to call the master herder emerges. And I use this term to describe a strong, compassionate, well-balanced leader who also acts as a caretaker and a guardian. And so such a person has to master five rules of power and social influence. They have to be able to use them fluidly as needed. These roles, most people in our culture are familiar with these roles. Most people are good at one or two of them. But to really function at a high level with free, empowered people, you need to have access to when and how to use all five.
Yeah. And you know, when you think of herders, or at least most of us who are not familiar with these cultures, you think of people just moving animals from point A to point B. But there's a lot that goes on there, and a lot of it is, as you write, nonverbal. What kind of signals do herders pick up, or do they give back and forth to the animals they're tending to?
Here's the thing, is that when you're dealing with animals that are powerful, like horses and cattle, and even sheep, people often use the word sheeple when they're joking about how easy mm-hmm. people are to herd around, mm-hmm. but it's actually much more difficult to even herd sheep than the average person understands when the sheep are loose, and or the horses or the cattle. And so if they're loose, you have to build trust and you have to keep them together. And if you if you get over aggressive with them, they simply run off. And so by being overly aggressive and just pushing the animals around, you can actually scatter the herd and spend hours trying to get them all back together again. So this over-the-top feeling of, you know, aggressive, intimidating forms of power that herd others around, let's say, is actually not at all what you need in order to function. when there are no fences and there's no restraints. So the other thing is that to break up fights between adolescent 1,000-pound bulls and stallions, let alone mares and cows, you actually have to be incredibly powerful yourself. You have to be able to stand up to these animals and step into the middle of a fight and get them to move away from each other and then herd them away from each other. Otherwise, they'll injure each other and you can actually lose animals that way.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find with these master herders is that they are incredibly powerful. And at the same time, they also spend a large amount of their day just moving among the animals, nurturing them, petting them, scratching them, taking care of them, milking them, helping children be born, so that this incredible power that can bring them life is also very much balanced by very solid trust-building, nurturing, and companionship-type activities.
What started you down this path with horses, and what eventually led you to write the book?
Well, this is my fifth book. I've been writing about what horses have to teach people since my first book, The Tao of Equus, was released in 2001. What happened was I was working in the music business, and I was program director of a radio station, and was also a music critic and put on music festivals. And you know, when you're wrangling really talented people who work in music and radio, you know, it's like handling a herd of feisty racehorses. I mean, when they're well cared for and well conditioned, they're worth millions. But these, you know, sometimes feisty and aggressive, egotistical beings don't necessarily get along with each other, and they don't necessarily all move in the same direction. And so what I found was that people were driving me crazy, and I decided to get a horse to ride off into the desert just to get away from human insanity. What I found was that rather than getting away, my horse was demanding that I become a much more balanced leader, trustworthy leader, but also someone who was strong enough to be able to stand up to a 1,000-pound animal and also calm that animal when that animal was frightened. So through learning how to work with that horse and then a succession of horses over the years, I learned some skills that I could translate to human situations. And people at first noticed, because a lot of it is nonverbal, people at first noticed that I had shifted and I was different with people and I could handle things and I didn't get upset by things that used to upset me or upset the average person. And they were like, what have you done? What are you learning? And I'm like, well, I've just been working with horses and then generalizing some of this back to the human world. And eventually I left my career in the music business and in radio, and I began teaching all kinds of people how to become better humans and more effective with groups of humans through working with horses on the ground. So you don't actually have to ride a horse. You never even have to have wanted to be with a horse before. I teach people at radio missile systems to be engineers to become better leaders through working with horses on the ground. I teach parents how to become more effective parents with working with horses on the ground, because parenting is a leadership role. And then when you start to get into situations where we see a lot of times now people are engaging in groups to start to become more socially active, to try to create change in a very contentious, intense political system right now, all of a sudden, you have to have some socially intelligent leadership skills to make that change and move forward and deal with a lot of the aggressive people that you're going to come across.
And we learn from the book, first of all, that you have so much understanding and compassion for animals, but also how this impacts the social fabric, as you said, of the country. And I'm wondering, how do you feel about things like animals and their use in entertainment? For instance, circuses and things like that, they tend to be put through some ridiculous paces, I think. And I'm just wondering, how do you feel about seeing horses or elephants or anything like that being put through those, into those exhibits?
There's definitely people I've seen who form real partnerships with animals that actually like to entertain. There are some animals, that, especially horses, there's some gregarious horses that like to be competitive, that like to race. There are some engaged horses that love to show. And then there are other horses that they don't like it. So the ones that are being forced into that situation is not a good thing. And in general, I think that we're seeing a move away from circus-type exhibits, but we've also had things like an amazing horse show called Cavalia, where people are doing amazing work with horses in a show setting, but the horses are actually very well respected and taken care of, and the horses are actually taught to improvise with the humans and are actually having fun. So I wouldn't say no to it, but I would like to see animals that are suited to this work, who like to do it, who are given a choice and not just sort of run into the ground like machines, to be able to show humans what's possible in these interspecies relationships.
And I have to think, too, with the way you deal with horses and interact and all of the compassion that you show, that do you think there's no such thing as breaking a horse, breaking a stallion, breaking its will, essentially?
Well, there is such a thing as that. People have been using this technique for years. People have also been doing it to people, breaking them. Mm-hmm. I meet a lot of people who come and study with me with the different kinds of workshops that I do, who have truly been broken by overly aggressive parents or spouses. Their spirit has been broken. And so by working with a horse that has been allowed to have choice, a horse that's become empowered, that has kept their soul intact through mutually respectful relationships with humans, these people can be inspired and learn some ways to come back. Also, the interesting thing is that horses are not predators. And so with horses, you learn how to be powerful without being predatory. Human beings are omnivores. We have characteristics of predator and non-predator. Most humans who are victimized are preyed upon by predatory members of their own species. And so when I've worked with, in some cases, I also work with mental health professionals to work with people who've survived really extreme violent situations, such as rape or kidnapping. And one of the things that's hard for somebody who's been victimized in this way is for them to come back into life as an empowered being who's capable of protecting themselves and protecting their family. But they don't want to use power because they've seen it so profoundly misused. And so for them to learn how to be powerful like a horse, which is a non-predatory power animal, is an incredible inspiration and a way for them to learn how to use power appropriately to really step into their lives again.
Our guest on this Chief for Yourself is Linda Kohanov, author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. When we look at the five roles of the master herder, dominant leader, sentinel, nurturer, companion, and predator, the first two seem to be similar. One might also often think they're the same, but dominant and leader are not the same thing, are they?
No, one of the interesting things that you learn from these nomadic pastoral cultures is that they know, because they've learned from the animals themselves, that among large herbivores like horses and cattle, the leader animal and the dominant animal they're often two different animals, and they perform different functions that lead, when it's used in a balanced way, that lead to the health and well-being of the entire herd. So these master herders learned what the leader animal does and looks like, and they also learned what the dominant animal does, and when the dominant role is used in balance with the other four roles, the dominant role breaks up fights between animals. You need to use the dominant role for that, or to herd animals away from danger and in the same direction, you need the dominant role for that. And the leader really is an animal that is more out in front, that actually can calm and focus other animals in a crisis. They often are really at their best in a novel situation, so that they see something new, and while most animals will run away from the new thing, and the dominant animal is so protective it will automatically herd everyone away from the new thing, the leader animal will come forward and, with the appropriate amount of caution, move toward the new thing and assess its possible benefits, or let everybody know that, yes, indeed, this is a dangerous situation. So the dominant animal often is some level of pushing energy or divisive energy that, for instance, divides two animals away from danger, or divisive energy that breaks up a fight. But the leader animal uses a calming energy that is, they're calm. Those things are actually very attractive. Others tend to borrow their calmness and curiosity and follow that animal. So the master herders have learned, yes, at times we will act as the leader, and at times we will act as the dominant. And even among horses, certain animals are inclined to be naturally dominant. And when the dominant role is used in its immature form, it's actually pretty dangerous, very intimidating. But in herds of well-adjusted horses is that they actually don't reward immature dominant behavior. So they have ways of socializing overly aggressive stallions. And in our culture, you know, we have a lot of naturally dominant people that are still in an immature state. You can be 75 years old and be an immature dominant, mm-hmm. and that means that you're misusing your power rather than understanding when and how to use the dominant role in a mature fashion. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can overdo any of these, too. When you talk about applying these to a corporate situation, there are some ways that, heads are going to bump and people are going to feel hurt. What are some of the more outstanding ways that we see this in the office place as they apply to master herders?
The real difficulty I see in any kind of setting. It can be a corporate business setting, it can be entrepreneurial, it can be a social service agency, or, you know, a bunch of teachers at school, is that the problem we're having right now is that we do not have a sophisticated enough understanding of power and balanced leadership in order to function well. And the reason that is because people tend to try to specialize in one role or the other, or one or two roles, while abdicating other roles and trying to depend on other people to pick up the roles that they're not as good at. And the problem with this is that each side has a series of dysfunctional behaviors that occur when you overemphasize that role. Even a nurturer companion role can be incredibly toxic when somebody is overemphasizing that role in an organization or a family. So, for instance, people with really solid nurture companionship skills at work, they're great at making connections, they build trust and gain loyalty, they find out what people need to do to be supported in doing their job. But if you're overly invested in this role, you can be incredibly toxic when you lack the skills with the other roles. So nurture companions can be experts at passive-aggressive manipulation. They act out anger and frustration in secretive ways that make it hard for supervisors to catch difficulties in their earliest stages. I've seen, as a major pattern, nurture companions who feel wronged in some way, they don't address the issue directly. They tend to hold grudges and undermine people behind their backs. Eventually, they'll pretty much refuse to communicate with whoever they perceive to be an offender, which can become quite a problem. So, you know, simply by giving each other the silent treatment, key staff members can make it hard for others to get their jobs done. And over time, factions are created, with each side feeling undermined by the others. Classic pattern of toxic nurture companion behavior that's not because this person is evil or doing this consciously, simply because they're overemphasizing a role.
You know, I took the master assessment that you include in the book that readers can take for themselves. And I scored highest in Sentinel and close to that in Nurture Companion. What does that tell me about my own score?
I guess I'd have to see the scores in relation to each other. But it does mean that just noticing that the Sentinel and the Nurturer are your two highest roles, you're going to want to go to the book and look at the list of the high functioning abilities of those two roles and make sure you keep those high functioning abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But also look at the dysfunctions that occur when those roles are overemphasized and realize, oh, and be honest with yourself and say, well, yeah, maybe I do engage in some of these dysfunctional behaviors over time. And what I really need to do is to learn how to fade out of the dysfunctional behaviors and bring in some of the other functional, high-functioning behaviors of the other role.
Hmm. Okay. I wonder, because I was pretty low-scoring in leader and dominant, and the scores, the two highest scores were 45 and 41, to be exact. But leader and dominant and predator were also very low, and I thought I must be very meek in the workplace, which I don't know. I hardly had a reputation for that, but then again, maybe this is my nature. I'm not sure. But yes, I will refer to the book and get drill down on that a little bit.
And what I'm curious about too is which is higher, your dominant score or your predator score?
Let me see, dominant score or predator score. The higher of the two was dominant.
Okay, that's good.
Oh.
At least that, because in general, what I found with some people who overemphasize the sentinel or nurture companion role is that their predator score will sometimes be higher than their dominant score, which means that they're conflict averse and they're not willing to step in, you know, and really deal with conflict from a position of strength, that they go immediately towards, you know, firing people or leaving situations, rather than going to the place where, I'm not having much success with the nurturing role here. I guess I'm going to have a little backbone to step in and start to address some issues with this person. A lot of times you'll see a nurturer with a higher predator score because they won't do that. Instead, they just support and support and support, and finally one day they pat it, and they either fire people or they leave the situation.
Just out of curiosity, I know you worked in radio, as you mentioned, and I was in that business for quite a few years. And it seems like, I'm going to be gentle here and say, certain personality types are drawn to that. Is there anything using the Master Herder assessment that we can, identify in the quote-unquote typical radio person?
I don't know. I was in radio for a number of years, and I saw a wide variety of people.
Really?
I think maybe if you're dealing with, like, commercial radio morning announcers, they probably are a little bit more on the dominant side. But I worked in a lot of FM and arts radio. I had some more, I had a number of colleagues who were very much more the nurturing types and, you know, sensitive artist types, really. What kind of behavior do you see in radio that makes you think it would be one particular role?
Very, aggressive, outgoing, narcissistic sometimes. Then again, you sound as though you've worked with more adults in the room than I have. I've done more of the morning zoo kind of stuff.
Zoo. I mean, that's the reason they call it that, right?
<That's> right.
It attracts a
certain kind of person. Your website is opponaquest.com, and I just wanted to, before we go, have you tell us a little bit about the work of OponaQuest.
Sure. I actually have trained over 300 instructors on 5 continents how to do this work, equine facilitated learning, where people can come and work with horses. You don't have to have horse experience. You're not riding. You work with horses on the ground. And you do these really engaging exercises with the horses that help you become assertive without being aggressive and help you step into the mature use of the dominant role while also combining it with the mature use of the nurturer companion role, teaches you how to have a really highly developed sentinel that's functioning at all times, and how you learn how to actually engage the leader role, which is the most difficult for a lot of people to learn with a horse that's off lead, which is to get this horse to follow you off lead because of your confidence and charisma and your engagement with the horse. So once you can set boundaries with a 1,000-pound animal and entice them into a place where they're willing and interested in following you, doing this with your 200-pound dog, your, you know, 18-year-old son or daughter or your spouse, it's so much easier. And you begin to see and use the various rules as tools rather than over-identifying with one or two. The other thing is that I have another site called masterherder.com, and if you go to that site, you can actually take the professional assessment that's in the book. You can take it online and have the scoring done for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that site also lists a variety of workshops that are available that I do here in Arizona with my herd, as well as when I travel around the world, as well as instructors who are qualified to teach this work in various places on five continents. So this year I'm going to France and Belgium and Australia also, but still we have a number of really exciting workshops coming up that really help you learn these skills that change your life in just a matter of days.
Right. The book is The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership, from our guest, Linda Kohanov. Linda, thanks for being with us today and for bringing us your insights and evolved ways of management and overall change. I wish you the best and invite you to come back and talk with us again.
Thank you, John. I would love it. And it was a pleasure talking with you.
And we will link to our guest's website, or websites, I should say, as you heard her mention. She has a couple of them that are worth your attention, so we'll direct you there on the chieforyourself.com homepage. And while I'm talking about the homepage, that is a place where you can sign up for Genuline's blog posts, and that'll get you information as far as who's going to be on and when. That is going to do it for today. As always, many thanks for being with us, for your likes and follows. They are always appreciated. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.